This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Lisa Taylor, Education Program Manager for Seattle Tilth, a nonprofit that cultivates a healthy urban environment and community by teaching people to grow organic food and conserve natural resources. Lisa is a co-author of the Maritime Northwest Garden Guide and a frequent speaker on soils, compost, edible landscaping, and children's gardening. Lisa Taylor is here today to tell us about her book, Your Farm in the City, an urban dweller's guide to growing food and raising animals, co-authored with the Gardeners of Seattle Tilth and published in 2011. Welcome, Lisa.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be here.
It's good to have you.
Yeah.
Would you like to begin by saying a few words about Seattle Tilth?
Sure. We're a nonprofit organization, as you said. Our mission is to teach and inspire folks to garden organically, and we're maybe responsible for all the worm bins in the backyards in Seattle and everywhere across the country. We do our education mission through a number of different ways. We have demonstration gardens where folks can see what they can do in their backyard as far as cultivating food or growing other plants organically. We also have volunteer opportunities, so folks come and learn through hands-on methods. We've just started a couple farm programs, which we're really excited about, to help mentor both teens and immigrant farmers in farming and business skills. And then where I spend most of my days, in the children's garden, where we invite families and children into the garden and teach them everything that goes into making a garden and explore the creatures and eat the plants.
Why did you write your book, Your Farm in the City? What is your purpose?
Well, for many years, we've been answering questions and teaching folks at Seattle Tilth to grow their own food. And it's been hard to help folks who are just starting out, who really don't have any skills at all, who haven't experienced gardening as a young person, but they're very excited and they want to do this. So my goal was to try to give a comprehensive treatment of growing your own food in a city, to take all the different organic gardening techniques and put them together to help folks grow maybe a good tomato or two or a cucumber in their backyard or on their decks.
What is your definition of urban farming?
You know, that's a new term. It's exciting, but I think it's an old idea. We used to just call ourselves organic gardeners and we knew what we meant, but I don't really know anything about ornamentals. I have spent all my time learning and growing things I can eat. So urban farming, I think, is a term folks are using to identify themselves as folks who want to grow plants you can eat.
What do you see as the overall benefits of urban gardening?
Well, I think there's a lot of different benefits of getting outside, enjoying fresh air, exercise, natural light, being connected with nature and the natural cycle. I think there's some economic benefits. You're not driving to the store to purchase all of your produce. For a small investment, you can grow an awful lot of food in a small place. I think there's also some health benefits. I find that if I'm growing kale, I eat more kale. And I think folks who grow their own food in their backyards find that too. We're eating more fresh vegetables when we grow them ourselves. And then the last thing, and I don't even want to push it out of the way because I think it's really important, is the mental health benefits. Working in nature, around plants, around lots of colors, very soothing. And studies have shown, actually, that there's bacteria in the soil that increase your serotonin levels. So working in the soil actually does make you feel better.
What type of farming is most feasible in an urban environment? What are the special challenges?
Well, I think each site is unique, and each farmer is unique. You may be interested in going whole hog, taking all the lawn up in the front yard and putting in a garden, or you may be interested in a couple of containers with some fresh herbs that you can use for cooking with. So I think each site and each farmer is unique. I think the thing that distinguishes urban farming from conventional farming is our space. We have to be very creative. We have to mix up our techniques a lot. We might have raised beds and containers, and we might have a garden scattered around our property in the best locations to get the best sun and to be most convenient for us to care for those plants.
What are the minimum requirements space-wise for urban farming?
Oh, you know, how big a pot can you fit in a sunny corner of your deck? Again, depends on what your goals are. If you're going to have livestock, you're going to need some space for a chicken coop or a goat enclosure. I've been thinking about raising honeybees, and I realize although I have a big enough property, I don't have the right space yet. There is a play structure in the space where the honeybees should go. And so sometimes the space needs to change and time needs to progress before you can add some of these really neat features to your urban farm.
Which fruits and vegetables are easiest to grow in an urban environment?
Well, I always say to grow the things that you like to eat, but I think for folks in Seattle, starting out with things like tomatoes or peppers or eggplants are the hardest things to grow for us. So I would start with things that like a cool, temperate climate. Brassicas, anything that belongs to the cabbage tribe, arugula, cabbage, mustards, turnips, radishes, kale, collard greens, all very easy to grow here. I love to grow leeks. They're an investment. They take a long time to grow, but they're worth the time. Once they're in the ground, they require some watering and some fertilizer, but really they just grow on their own, and then I enjoy the harvest later. So I think starting with things that you like to eat, things that are expensive at the store that don't keep very well, like salad greens. I like to grow a lot of salad greens or cilantro, things like that, things that'll grow quickly that I can harvest quickly and use straight away.
Would you speak now about the issue of pollution in the urban environment? What are the key sources?
Well, you know, pollution is not my expertise, but I do know that water is huge and it's a big part of urban gardening and farming. So I think that water runoff of our lawns, especially if we're using any kinds of chemicals or weed and feed. As far as urban farmers, one area of pollution you might be concerned about is growing food next to a busy roadway. Particulates in the air from auto exhaust and other things can land on your vegetables. So you want to be careful where you're going to grow your food. If the only place I can grow is close to the street, then I'm going to try to grow things that are easy to wash, that I can wash very well before I prepare them. I might use some mulch to sort of create a barrier between the soil. The particulates might land in the mulch and I could remove that. Also, planting next to houses where there might be lead paint. I usually like to stay out about 10 feet from the foundation of any house to avoid any kinds of pollution that way.
How good is the quality of urban soil on the whole?
Well, you know, urban soils are not naturally occurring. They've been disturbed quite a bit, and they're inherited. Generally, when houses are built, you know, everything that might have been good is scraped off, and the soil is compacted by heavy boots and equipment, and the house is constructed. And then the land that has been abused is generally not amended before turf is rolled out and planted or an azalea or a rhodi is planted. So a lot of times when folks are starting to garden, they're encountering very, very poor soils. And in Your Farm in the City, I spend a lot of time talking about soil building because with healthy soil, we grow healthy plants resist disease and pests and make it easy for us. So when you start gardening a virgin site in the city, you can pretty much expect something that's going to be difficult to work with. So using compost and mulches, using sheet mulching is a great way to build soil from the top down. And then once the microorganisms and the worms and their friends have done a lot of work there, it'll be much easier for you to cultivate.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Lisa Taylor, Education Program Manager for Seattle Tilth, and author of the book, Your Farm in the City, An Urban Dweller's Guide to Growing Food and Raising Animals. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What are your recommendations for managing irrigation in an urban environment?
Well, when I started writing this book, I knew so much about growing and teaching, but there were some things that I hadn't necessarily taught in depth. And when I started working on the water chapter, I thought it would be a short chapter. I thought, I'll just breeze through that chapter. And I came to realize that watering tools and water are some of the most constantly used things in the garden when you're growing vegetables. So thinking out your watering system is important. Buying tools that are durable, that have few moving parts, so that when they drop in the soil, the parts don't fuse up and they're no longer usable. Drip irrigation is one of the things that a lot of folks aspire to. And I tell you, when I've gotten a drip system to work, it has been great. But it does require a lot of maintenance and some know-how. And you can't fear plumbing if you're going to do a drip irrigation system. I tend to like to interact with my plants an awful lot. I like to be out in the garden. I find that's the best success I have when I'm growing vegetables. So I use sprinklers and water breakers and a few drip lines. So I mix up my techniques. It certainly isn't easy for me. I think if I had drip lines set up, that would be the easiest. But as I said, I like to interact with the plants and be out there a lot and doing watering by hand or setting sprinklers or drip lines is one way that I can be out maintaining the garden and also doing an important job.
Would you comment also on collecting rainwater for gardening?
Well, a lot of people collect rainwater and, you know, in the city of Seattle, the city has subsidized rain barrels and folks are into that because when it rains here, it rains a lot and we see this precious resource. We should be able to keep that. And so putting a 55-gallon drum underneath a downspout is a great way to catch some water. That water isn't going to last a long time. 55 gallons isn't enough to really do much as far as watering a landscape. A lot of folks are starting to install larger cisterns. I think when you're thinking about doing rainwater harvesting, really the surface of your roof is the first place I would start, and then kind of about your goals. So is the surface of the roof acceptable for rainwater collection? Composites are sometimes tricky. We generally would say to filter most rainwater coming off of roofs, and we mostly use that rainwater for ornamental. If you've got a metal roof, then it's just the metal, and so collecting that water and using that for your vegetable garden would certainly be suitable. I have a little sidebar in the book that talks about the different roofing materials and whether they're suitable for ornamentals, edibles, or something that you shouldn't collect.
And that's based on contaminants coming out of the roof and getting into the water.
Yeah. Regardless of the surface of your roof, usually during the first flush of rain, folks recommend that you divert the water to flush off any particulates that have collected on top of the roof, and then you can collect after that.
For a new urban farmer, what's the best way to start?
Start small. Plant a small garden that you can maintain and start a little worm bin or a compost pile. Harvest what you grow and learn as much as you can. Take a class and talk to other folks. Visit gardens, go on garden tours. We have a great urban livestock tour coming up in July, sponsored through Seattle Tilth, and that'd be a great opportunity to see what is possible in an urban landscape as far as growing food and raising small animals.
What are the best options for someone who lives in an apartment or a condominium with no ground outside to grow food on?
You can still grow food even if you don't have a patch of soil. In fact, a lot of us with soil have places that get lots of sun that don't have soil. So growing in containers is a great option for folks if you've got a deck or a balcony or something like that. You can grow anything in a container. You just need a large enough container. If you don't have a deck or balcony, there's this really cool technology. It's a DIY technology that emerged out of New York called window farming. And it's kind of like this little hydroponic do-it-yourself out of 2-liter Coke bottles, clear plastic bottles, and you can grow all kinds of food that way.
What are the most common mistakes in starting an urban garden?
Oh, I don't know what the most common, but I can tell you what some of my mistakes have been. And placement of the garden has been one of the things I realized. Why wasn't I able to make that garden bed work this last season? And I think about where the garden was, how hard or easy it was to get to, how difficult or easy it was to get water to that garden. I can't tell you how many times I've cultivated a little patch. Great sunny spot, nice and level, fit all the things that the books tell you need. But it was in a place I never frequented in my yard. And so after cultivating, I basically forgot about it. So I think finding a really good place close to a main pathway is important. I also think that folks get really caught up in the excitement of growing food, and it is very exciting, without sort of setting definite goals or a budget. Writing down a number, a budget for yourself, how much money you plan to spend on this growing food thing will help you stay on track. If you don't know what you're doing, and it's your first year, and you spend $500 on plants and soil, and half of them die, it's not going to be a very good experience. So I usually recommend that folks start small. As they are able to maintain and care for a garden bed, then they can start expanding.
Well, we've been talking about plants, but you also speak in your book about urban farm animals.
Oh, yeah.
What are the benefits of keeping animals on urban farms?
Well, I keep chickens, and they're sort of the darling of the livestock set. They're the sort of one of the first urban animals that got all the press. And chickens are great. They produce fresh eggs that are beyond compare. They're great for composting. My chickens do a lot of work for me. They eat leftover food waste and also weeds that I pull from my garden. And they convert that into manure that I can recycle back into the garden. And they are great entertainment. The other animals that folks are keeping commonly in cities are ducks, rabbits, miniature goats, and honeybees. Honeybees are great. It's exciting to see urban folks starting to keep bees. They pollinate 85% of our crops, so they're very important. And they can produce honey, which is a nice local source of a sweetener. Dairy goats, thanks to some crusading folks here in the city of Seattle, it was the Goat Justice League. I don't know if they wear capes or have an insignia, but they should. Anyway, they were very interested in folks being able to keep small dairy goats in the city, and they worked with our city council and our city leaders to change land use codes so that folks can keep those. And folks are keeping dairy goats for milk and the products you can make with goat milk, but also for fiber and also for manure. So a lot of these animals are multi-purpose. They can be used for a lot of different things.
What are some of the key problems that have come up as a result of having urban farm animals?
Well, I haven't seen any news flashes about wild marauding chickens or goats on a rampage. I think problems can sometimes just be between neighbors and perception. And I've found that most folks who are keeping urban farm animals are pretty open and excited about it and are real willing to reach out to their neighbors to let them know what's going on and what they're doing, and to share some of the products. So I think being a good neighbor when you have urban livestock is important, and sharing eggs or milk or that kind of thing, or even manure if you've got a neighbor who's an avid gardener, is a great way to make sure that problems don't occur.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Lisa Taylor, Education Program Manager for Seattle Tilth and author of the book, Your Farm in the City, An Urban Dweller's Guide to Growing Food and Raising Animals. Would you comment briefly on city ordinances that either promote or discourage urban farming?
Well, I think in the city of Seattle, the city leaders have really worked hard to make it easier for folks to have animals and also to start small businesses and sell some of the produce that they grow on their city lots. So I think cities are starting to open up to this idea that folks can be part of, you and I, we can be part of the local food system, and that there's a lot of land that is sitting that could be made productive for folks. And there's nothing like truly locally grown fruits and vegetables that don't have to even be brought from 50 miles or 100 miles away, that can be grown in neighborhoods and shared right where they're grown.
Let's speak just briefly now about garden pests.
Well, I love the bugs.
Would you like to talk about insects and how they benefit and how they discourage gardens?
You know, Diane, when I started gardening, I thought I would be like a plant expert. I'd know all the botanical names and I'd sound really smart. And I found, mostly because I work in the children's garden, that the botanical names didn't mean a lot to us. And that really what was most interesting in the garden were the creatures. And working with small people, they notice things that are on the ground. And so we've learned together about all the different creatures that are in the garden. And, you know, 95% of what you see in the garden is beneficial, or it feeds beneficial insects. So I almost didn't even want to put pests in there, because I don't even really think about even insects that'll eat your plants as pests. I can see a greater purpose of how they work in the garden. But I do like to point out how beneficial bugs exist with those that eat our plants, but without the ones that eat the plants, there's no food for the beneficials. So aphids are a very common thing that vex a lot of gardeners, and they are gross for sure when they're present in large numbers and sticky. But they feed so many beneficial creatures. I had this experience where we had some fava beans that had this terrible aphid infestation, and it was a nightmare. It was a horror show. And we had to decide, do we take these out or do we leave them? And we decided to leave them and watch what happened. And we knew ladybugs would show up, and sure enough, they did, and their larvae, and we watched that whole life cycle go on. But we also noticed serif flies and green lacewings. We noticed wasps and bald-faced hornets were eating the aphids, and even small songbirds were eating these tiny creatures. So it gave us a bigger appreciation of how this little creature that we could perceive as something maybe the unwanted in the garden, fit into a bigger scheme of things. And so we do a lot of catch and release. You know, when we find slugs or snails, we catch them, we enjoy them, we learn about them, we race them, we categorize them, we count them. And then we release them in a wild area where they can live and be food for other creatures in the garden, and where we can find them again when we want to.
Would you comment also on four-legged, quote-unquote, pests?
Yes. Well, those are the thugs. Those are the thugs. In the city, we are faced with a number of thugs. Nothing like having those three precious ears of corn harvested the night before you had intended to pick them by the raccoons in the neighborhood. So I think that being aware that there are other bigger creatures in the urban landscape and that sometimes they like to feast on your garden is important. There are a number of suggestions. Some of them are just really hard. There's nothing to be done but to coexist with squirrels, I think, in some instances. But I do give some suggestions about raccoons and others. And really, whenever we're dealing with a pest or an unwanted creature in the garden, we need to understand about that creature, their life cycle, their habits and habitats, and then we can start to make a place that's not as conducive to that creature. And hopefully they'll find someplace else to be.
Well, you mentioned raccoons and squirrels. What are some other four-legged creatures that tend to be a problem in the city?
Well, rodents, rats are a huge issue. They're everywhere. They outnumber us 13 to 1. And so they can be a problem, especially when you keep chickens or with composting. So being careful and being diligent, making sure that you don't set up a bed and breakfast for rodents is important. And also, bears are coming into the city. So it's important that you understand that a compost bin could be attractive or blueberry bushes attractive to a bear that's coming down into our outlying suburbs. I stay in the house if you see a bear. That's what I say. Stay in the house.
You've alluded a bit to this, but would you describe your own garden? What is it like?
Well, it's in Shoreline, and it was a blank slate when we bought it about 6 or 8 years ago. So it was a rhododendron and a bunch of bad lawn. And we have removed most of the lawn and just a little patch in the back for badminton and picnicking. We have included edible plants all around the garden, berry vines and grapes and fruiting trees. And then according to where our sun patterns are and where our use patterns, where we find ourselves most likely outside, we have created garden beds. So they're kind of scattered around the garden. We've got an herb spiral full of vegetables. Who said an herb spiral had to be full of herbs? So we've planted our herb spiral with vegetables, and we've integrated garden beds here and there where the sun and the microclimates are best conducive to growing vegetables. In the backyard, I've struggled with a very silty soil and a very soggy winter condition. So I've been building up and using lots of creative containers. I've been planting in burlap sacks the last few years, and they make excellent raised bed containers. And burlap is a great recycled resource that we find here in Seattle quite often. So it's integrated, it's a jumble, and it's certainly unpredictable.
Would you mention now a few of the innovative organizations in different parts of the country that promote urban gardening? You mentioned those in your book.
Sure. There's lots of folks around all across the country doing some really exciting things. There's a wonderful project in Boston called the Food Project, which teaches teenagers how to grow food, and then they grow food for food banks and for farmers markets that they set up in neighborhoods that don't have access to fresh food. There is an organization called Urban Farming, and they're assisting folks in starting small gardens or urban farms, both organizations as well as individuals, to start growing some food on their own. Places like Milwaukee with Growing Power have really amazing opportunities for folks, both job opportunities around farming as well as making food available to folks in food deserts where there isn't a grocery store that sells fresh produce. So it's very exciting. One of the things that I learned about that I thought was really cool was spin farming. It started in Saskatoon, so I figured that's cold. That would probably work here. And basically, it's an idea about cobbling together square footage in a city, not contiguous square footage, but square footage maybe on the same block or the same small area in a neighborhood, and cobbling enough square footage together to have a half-acre farm and to make it a commercial enterprise. So you might have 600 square foot, and I might have 400, and our neighbor might have 1,200, and we work together in exchange for your land and water. I would give you a share of the produce. And it's a very interesting model that is definitely geared toward commercial farming and toward a three-harvest kind of cycle. So that's kind of exciting to me. That's sort of like back in the 70s when you were supposed to go out and get 2 acres and make $50,000. Now you can find a half acre in your city And with a lot of hard work, I think, you could maybe have a business that might support you. I thought that was really exciting.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
The message I want to really give folks is to give it a try, to plant something in their yards this year that they can eat. It's super fun. It's a great way to be connected to your landscape, to interact with it in a different way, and to make some use of your urban lands. Have fun doing it. Learn as much as you can and share the food you grow with your family or your community.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Lisa.
Thank you.
You have just been listening to Lisa Taylor, Education Program Manager for Seattle Tilth and author of the book, Your Farm in the City, An Urban Dweller's Guide to Growing Food and Raising Animals, co-authored with the Gardeners of Seattle Tilth and published in 2011 by Black Dog and Leventhal Publishers. For more information, check on the web at www.seattletilth.org. Again, that's seattletilth.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.